Support for State Week comes from the following sponsors: Visit Springfield, PI.org, and the Illinois Education Association.
From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, property taxes are a real problem in Illinois, and they've been so for a while. Where does the blame lie? It's complicated, but the governor seemed to target local school districts as a culprit for not doing more to hold taxes down. We'll discuss that. We'll also get an update on some of the latest court action in Illinois. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus, and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime Statehouse reporter and observer. And our guest this week could have back on the show Hannah Meisel, a reporter for Capital News Illinois. Hannah, thanks for being with us.
Always glad to be with you.
So property taxes, I mentioned they're burdensome for many people. It can make it hard for some people to even stay in their homes. This has been going on for years, Hannah, but there seems to be a little more renewed discussion on this recently. What is happening with the legislature and with some of the state officials talking more about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of fits into the broader Democratic narrative this year, last year, of this affordability crisis. It also comes at a time when we are locked into this ongoing war with Iran. And in the last 6 weeks, we've seen gas prices just skyrocket. And, you know, I think for Democrats, it adds even more fuel to the fire. But like you said, property taxes in Illinois, this is not a new issue. This is, a perennial issue that goes back to before I was born, and I am redacted years old. This idea of implementing a possible surcharge for millionaires, this millionaires tax, again, not even a new idea. I was, I think, an intern in 2014 when then Illinois Speaker Mike Madigan, kind of as a thumbing his nose to millionaire candidate, gubernatorial candidate Bruce Rauner, put a non-binding referendum, or pushed for a non-binding referendum, be on the ballot that November for a millionaire's tax, which voters did approve. Of course, it being non-binding, it didn't actually do anything. I think that this, you know, this is something that a lot of voters have had an appetite for a long time. But as they say, the devil's in the details. You know, when you put numbers, to do a constitutional amendment with, numbers on it, it is difficult because things change and you don't want to have to go back to voters over and over and over again. You know, the last time that voters did directly weigh in on this question of whether rich people should pay more in income taxes in Illinois was in 2020. You know, the long-awaited fruition of Governor Pritzker's campaign promises going back to 2017 that he would, you know, push for a graduated income tax, what he called the fair tax, and he put millions of dollars behind this campaign. And due to a lot of things, and voters, you know, rejected this. And I think that opponents also made salient points in their oppositional ads that, you know, you can't necessarily trust that these numbers would remain the same, and it might be a creeping down, you know, over time that would capture, you know, more middle class earners. The whole point, though, is that, you know, for years and years and years, decades, really, Illinois' entire way of, funding things, I would say primarily schools, because schools are predominantly supported by property taxes. It's a system that's really, really hard to change. It's, you know, like trying to turn around an ocean liner, because when you've always done things the same way, it's very difficult to change. And I think the 2020 vote kind of proved that Illinois voters don't necessarily trust Illinois government. I think one of the most, the time that Springfield got the closest to actually addressing this was in the early 90s, when Comptroller Don Clark Netsch proposed this this tax swap, which would have increased income taxes to then give school districts more money. And so school districts could not levy as much in property taxes. In the early 90s, this tax swap idea had been gaining steam, but even though Governor or Jim Edgar did beat Don Clarknech to win the governor's mansion, and he was kind of an opponent of the idea at the time when he became governor, he actually kind of embraced the idea under a slightly different name. But then ultimately, Republicans in the Illinois Senate killed the idea. Again, that's the closest state government has been to actually addressing this problem. I think that Democrats could push it through on this idea of affordability, but they're going to have a really good strategic and fast campaign to do so. And I'm just not sure that with everything else going on, there is the political wherewithal to pull it off this year.
Yeah, Charlie the Pritzker, of course, coming out and talking about property taxes, and he went on about how the state under his administration has given more money to school districts, and that school districts may be, what did he say, not getting the hint, not taking the hint that, hey, we're giving you more state dollars, so it's time for you to hold off a bit on the property tax levies. But you didn't like his answer there.
No, I didn't. I thought he was accurate in that he said school districts are the main beneficiaries of property taxes, and their levies have kept increasing. And that is all true. But what he left out was the context that school districts aren't immune to inflation any more than an average household is. They have to pay more for the goods that they buy. I mean, even things like, I'm sure that the school districts don't get a the transportation doesn't get a cut at the pump saying, oh yeah, the gas prices are going up for everybody else, but you're a school district, so we're going to charge you the same prices that we did a year ago. They don't get a break. They can buy stuff in bulk, but still it's not that they're immune to the outside economic forces. And so I don't particularly think that school districts are profligate. And if you look at it, Illinois probably, I don't want to say they have the lowest proportion of school district costs paid by the state than anybody else, but we're pretty near the bottom. Many other states put a lot more money into their school districts, therefore the property taxes don't have to be so high. But here, school districts rely mainly on property taxes to be able to pay the everyday costs, things like teacher salaries, things like running the building, things like making repairs when they're needed. And property taxes are the main driver. Now, we have embarked upon a program called evidence-based funding, and we've talked about this in the past. And what that means is that each school district is evaluated based on the number of kids it has, the economic viability of the neighborhood, how many English learners there are, how many kids with developmental disabilities, all kinds of different factors. And they come up with a number and says, well, for you to be able to adequately educate your particular student population, this is how much money you need. Now, here's how much you get from the state. And we're embarking upon a program where the districts that are furthest away from what they need are going to get the lion's share of new state money every year. And so a wealthy district will get just a token, and very poor districts, based on this formula, will get a lot more. And so, yeah, we put in probably at least $300 million in the last, when did evidence-based funding get in? It was when Bruce Rauner was governor. So we put in at least that much every year. But at the same time, the costs are increasing. And that's where the rubber hits the road. And to kind of go off on a tangent, a lot of the states that are able to put more in education also have a more, what would you say, have a more up-to-date revenue structure. A lot of states' sales tax includes services. When the sales tax was implemented, most of the transactions involve tangible stuff. Hannah has a, let's say Hannah has a garden and she sells me tomatoes. Nowadays, most of what happens in Illinois doesn't involve transfer of tangible goods. It would be more like I'm a barber and I cut Sean's hair and I charge him for the haircut, but there's no service tax. And other states have service taxes, and that brings in a lot of money. Now, this is a long discussion about revenue, but the bottom line is, I think that we're making progress with the schools, and it's not fair to suggest that school districts are taking advantage of the system. One of the things also that happens, some few years back, we implemented tax caps for certain counties. That limits the amount of new money that a school district can ask for each year. And so in some of the suburban areas, school districts have asked for the maximum, because if they don't ask for it this year and they need more next year, they will be limited to what they asked for the year before. So there's all these factors that enter into it. So I would not blame school districts or the fact that superintendents are greedy. I don't think that's an accurate portrayal of what's really going on.
And I believe lawmakers have until May 3rd to try to pass a constitutional amendment that would go on the ballot this November if they want that millionaire's tax. You're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week comes from Visit Springfield, featuring dozens of attractions and overnights on Route 66 in the capital city. Springfield is home to numerous Lincoln sites, Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House, the Illinois State Capitol, and more. The Visit Springfield team can help organizers plan their event in the capital city. Attractions and tourism information at visitspringfieldillinois.com.
We're back on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, along with Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Well, Hannah, you spent a lot of time in the past year plus covering courts, and even more so since Donald Trump's second administration has come in. One of the big issues up there has had to do with ICE and what is going on or has gone on with the Operation Midway Blitz. In fact, lawmakers passed some legislation to limit where ICE could go around courthouses and things like that. But sounds like there may be some issues of whether or not they're following this law. Tell us what's happening.
Right. So back in October, which was pretty much the height of Operation Midway Blitz, Donald Trump's Chicago area focused mass deportation campaign, that's when lawmakers had their veto session. And of course, Democrats who control the General Assembly wanted to do something. There is, you know, there's really not a ton that as a state you can do, because there is this thing called the Supremacy Clause in the U.S. Constitution. In general, I think the Trump administration has shown that it's going to do what it's going to do. And, you know, one of the only things that it's responded to is federal lawsuits and, you know, Attorney General Kwame Raoul, along with many, many other Democratic attorneys general, have filed dozens and dozens of lawsuits, you know, against the Trump administration, trying to stop basically like every executive order, every action, et cetera. But, you know, one thing that Democratic lawmakers did do during veto session was pass this law that said, among other things, federal immigration agents could not arrest people, undocumented immigrants, for civil immigration cases. I want to be clear, civil immigration cases, not criminal, in and around state courthouses in Illinois. After the governor signed this into law in, I believe, December, pretty quickly, the Trump administration sued the state of Illinois, you know, saying that this law is, you know, basically unconstitutional. That litigation is still working itself out in the federal Southern District of Illinois. Cook County leaders, at the end of last week, along with immigration and domestic violence advocates, called a press conference together in response to an incident that happened in Cook County's dedicated domestic violence courthouse. They were pretty light on details, and I think that's because they genuinely don't have many, but it is apparently the fifth known instance since late February in which a federal agent has shown up in and around or around a Cook County courthouse and, you know, sought to detain someone. And, you know, they were sounding the alarm, particularly because apparently these incidents have gone on in the domestic violence courthouse which DV advocates say is particularly pernicious because kind of weaponizing people at one of their most vulnerable moments, like say, I am an undocumented immigrant and I was able to escape my abusive partner and I did go and seek law enforcement's help in filing for an order of protection or another avenue in the legal system. It's hard enough to report that. It's hard enough to fear retribution from your abusive ex-partner or even their family or friends. But then to add, the fear of, being made vulnerable to immigration authorities, that's a whole other layer. We can't say for sure if they're targeting DV because we also don't know that if these five incidents are the only ones, there could be many, many others, but because there's not really information sharing, we don't know.
Charlie, any thoughts on that? I mean, I'm guessing, like Hannah said, I don't think the administration, the Trump administration, really cares what Illinois does and isn't really that concerned about following the law.
No, and I think there was a comment in from Senator Graciela Guzman, who's a Chicago Democrat, and this is her quote: "The Trump administration, fully aware of Illinois law, has shown up at domestic violence court again and again." This is Senator Guzman. "They are not confused. They're not acting in a gray area. They are knowingly and willingly violating the law of this state." And I think that pretty much sums it up. And the administration apparently has the notion that if the supreme ruler says we can do it, we can do it. And we don't really care about whatever the 50 other states tell us.
So, Hannah, also a big ruling this week. Let me move on to the U.S. Supreme Court, took up a case that involved an Illinois law. Illinois bans guns being carried on public trains, public transit, like trains and buses. This had been struck down at the lower court level, but then an appeals court once again reinstated and upheld that law. Now the Supreme Court has decided not to take up the case, which basically means Illinois' law stays in place. So that's a victory for the Pritzker administration and a lot of others in state government who want that law and local government as well. What does it mean going forward? Because we have some other gun-related cases coming up.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of akin to a 2024 US Supreme Court ruling in which 8-1, the court upheld a law that limited gun access to people who had basically a domestic violence order of protection against them. In that ruling, the court reasoned that sort of limitation does go along with an originalist reading of the Constitution. Limiting guns from certain places for public safety, it seems like, of course, we don't have the, because they didn't opt to take up the case, we don't have the court's full reasoning and rationale. But, you could say that the court is, kind of saying that it's not a limitation that is so egregious that we believe it goes against, what would have the founders, the framers of the Constitution might have had in mind for a reasonable limitation at the time. But as you say, Illinois has other gun laws which are being tested in the courts. I think the biggest one of which is Illinois' assault weapons ban, which, if folks remember, Democrats in the General Assembly pushed that through in early 2023 in response to the horrific 4th of July parade shooting in Highland Park. That one is still working its way through the courts. I think at the time I would have thought that maybe we'd have seen a little bit more progress in 2026, but these things do take time. Folks who were, on the pro Second Amendment absolutist side are kind of weighing which state law would be the strongest case in front of the Supreme Court. As to your question of whether the court refusing to take up the public transit law ban has any bearing on the assault weapons case, I mean, the short answer is I don't know. I'm not really sure that we have heard a full reasoning from the US Supreme Court quite yet on just the notion of assault weapons. So it's going to be interesting.
All right, you're listening to State Week.
Support for State Week comes from PIORG, a nonprofit consulting firm providing resources for strategic planning, best practice implementation, and outcomes-focused program evaluation across the country, helping organizations make data understandable and actionable, enabling change makers to strengthen critical skills and serve others more effectively. PI, Plan, Implement, Evaluate. Services and information at piorg.org.
And we're back on State Week. We have just a few minutes left here. Hannah, I'll go back to you on the topic of something called prediction markets. Not everybody's familiar with this. We may have heard about sports gambling, but this has really risen up as an issue here in recent months and even last couple of years. These are not regulated like sports gambling. So what are they, and why is the Trump administration promoting them so heavily?
Yeah, you know, gosh, I wish we had more time to talk about this because it is a very complicated topic, but I'll try to condense as much as I can. You know, basically, prediction markets have existed in some form or another for decades and decades. For the most part, they've been very, very niche. There's this thing called the Iowa prediction market, which has, you know, operated for a very, very long time. But in the last few years, they have absolutely blown up. People might have heard of market leaders like Polymarket or Kalshi. Those are the two, you know, biggest and most well-known ones in the United States. Proponents of prediction markets say we are absolutely nothing like gambling. We're definitely not like sports betting, even though people do place bets on sports on these prediction markets. They say, no, we're basically like futures markets, which have been legal in the United States since the late 1800s. I think one of the many issues that people are concerned with beyond the advancement of rampant gambling addiction, which we've already seen from sports gambling in the last 8 years since the US Supreme Court legalized that, concerns about meddling in elections, et cetera, or, you know, insider trading. But beyond that, particularly Illinois lawmakers and other lawmakers around the country say, hey, this is completely unregulated, meaning that we are not getting a cut, you know, and in the case of course, sports betting, it's pretty big cut that the state gets. And, you know, this is a product very like sports betting. I think, you know, your typical consumer could not be able to tell you what the difference is. You know, Illinois' gaming regulator has, you know, tried to gently put bans on prediction markets. But even so, the Trump administration, I believe last week, sued Illinois over its attempt to regulate them. And so we'll see where it goes. But it's really the wild, wild west. And I think that the Trump administration embracing prediction markets exactly in line with the Trump administration also embracing cryptocurrency. And of course, Trump and his family have gotten wildly wealthy off of cryptocurrency in just the last couple years, you know, on top of everything else that they have done to gain wealth while they're also controlling the White House.
Yeah, Charlie, just a couple of seconds here, but Illinois, you know, the hands are not clean here in Illinois when it comes to embracing gambling as a way to raise revenue. But the fact that these aren't regulated, the fact the state gets no money from them, I can see why they're being looked at.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, there was a subcommittee of the state Senate earlier this week that had a hearing on legislation that would require prediction markets to acquire a license from the Illinois Gaming Board, pay a $1 million annual license fee, and the state would also collect a 50% privilege tax on the adjusted gross receipts derived from Illinois consumers. A platform that doesn't adhere to these rules would be treated as an unlicensed gambling operator and face civil penalties and possible criminal prosecution. And so the state is moving forward, although the Trump administration has said, no, you can't do that. And it's interesting to note that Trump's family is also involved in these prediction markets. His son, Donald Trump Jr., is an advisor to both Kalshi and Polymarket, and Trump Media and Technology Group Corporation has opened up its own marketplace. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. Ultimately, as one of the observers noted in one of the stories, it will wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court, and they will decide whether or not these prediction markets are really gambling or whether they're just like the stock market where the people buy shares hoping that they'll increase.
All right. Time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, we'll start with you this week.
Well, former Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan will be back in court, of course, not physically, because as we are taping this on Wednesday, April 8th, he has now officially been in a West Virginia federal prison for 6 months on his corruption conviction. But his very high-powered lawyers that he has hired to handle the appeal will be up in the Seventh Circuit appellate court in Chicago on Thursday afternoon, arguing that there was no bribery in his case, because bribery requires much more of an intent and, you know, explicit agreement. And relatedly, attorneys for the two of the so-called ComEd four, including lobbyist Mike McLean, a good friend of Madigan's, and former ComEd CEO Anne Pramaggiore, they will be making similar arguments next week on Tuesday.
Also, we talked last week about data centers. One of the projects discussed, one for Sangamon County, was approved this week by the county board. It's a $500 million project in the southwest part of the county outside of Springfield. It's from the company Cyrus One. It's said to employ hundreds of people during construction, expected to boost property tax revenues, but environmental concerns still remain. And Charlie.
Governor Pritzker, earlier this week, he called for President Donald Trump's removal from office for the threats that Trump made towards Iran. And Trump last week said on social media, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought again. I don't want that to happen, but it probably will. Thankfully, he backed off. And what Pritzker said on social media, he said, this is a quote, "This is not foreign policy. It's a deranged madman threatening to wipe out an entire country. It's past time that the 25th Amendment must be invoked." Now, the 25th Amendment, it would allow the vice president and cabinet members to decide that the president is incapacitated, can't carry out his duties, and then the vice president would take over. This amendment has never been used before, and as a practical matter, it's not going to happen now. But it's interesting that Pritzker and a number of other figures, including some really hardcore conservatives, are calling into question Trump's, basically his mental fitness.
Well, we'll continue to watch for that, I guess. That's all the time we have for State Week. And our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Hannah Meisel with Capital News Illinois. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Support for State Week comes from the members of the Illinois Education Association, serving 135,000 members of educators and support professionals around Illinois. IEA's mission is to promote excellence and equity in public education. When schools and communities unite, we all win. Resources and membership information at ieanea.org.